now we have things that could fit in your pocket, in your jeans, that could control an entire attraction. So that has been one of the biggest changes. And I think the next big change is how we arrive at the performances for those figures. How do we have an experience that feels organic, feels like it's happening in real time?
The World Beyond. Michael Mack and his Emotioneers of Tomorrow. The Mack One Podcast.
Hi, everybody. Michael Mack here, the founder and CEO of Mack One. Welcome to the World Beyond. Our team at Mack One creates innovative theme park designs and media-based entertainment. We are the Emotioneers of Tomorrow. In this episode, my colleague Christina Rees will explore what the future of tomorrow holds. Let's dive right in.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of The World Beyond. Today, I've got another very special guest here with me for you, Bill Butler. Bill is the Vice President of Creative Development at Gardner Holt, where he is responsible for innovative projects from the initial concepts to the final on-site programming and attraction commissioning. During his 15 years at Gardner, Bill has led teams responsible for the design of dozens of big attractions, shows, exhibits, and much more. He's been entrusted with projects for industry-leading clients like Disney, Universal, Europa Park, NASA, Mattel, Google, and many, many more. For his outstanding work, he has even received numerous awards, such as 7 prestigious TEA awards. I am thrilled to have you on Michael Mack's The World Beyond. Thank you so much for taking the time and coming here in person. Welcome to our Studio 78 here at Europa Park, Bill.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here again.
And we're excited to have you. Of course, you know Europa Park already, since you've implemented many things here before, such as Pirates in Batavia after the reconstruction.
That's right. Our company helped to conceive of most of the show scenes for that. I wrote the show script for that attraction and programmed every one of the animatronics in there, including about 55 that my company produced. So I've spent many, 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 many hours in Batavia here.
Brilliant. And it's such a beloved attraction. So I think we can all agree that you've done a brilliant job. We usually like to start the podcast by asking you 4 quick fire questions so that we can really get to know you a little bit more before we start with the main discussion. Are you ready?
Let's go.
1.
What is your dream vacation?
Gosh, you know, the last 2 weeks I was supposed to actually be on vacation here in Europe after some work at another park. And instead, I ended up going to other places to meet with clients and to 7 different theme parks. So I think that's it. I love the work so much that there isn't a vacation unless it involves theme parks and working and getting to meet with the people that do this fun, crazy stuff too.
2.
Who or what inspires you?
I'm inspired by the team at my company, Gardner Holt Productions. It is amazing to me that a company like ours takes a raw material, a piece of metal, a piece of wood, piece of plastic, piece of paper, in one door and out the other side comes something that looks like it's alive. It's totally magical. And it takes so many different talented people to do something like that, from our artists and our engineers, mechanical builders and machinists, figure finishers, painters, electronics specialists, literally any of the creative and technical disciplines put together. To me, that's so inspiring to see that start to finish creativity that means something. And we make something that is so magical that it entertains guests all over the world.
Sounds great.
3.
What's your favorite book or movie right now?
Gosh, my favorite book. I am rereading True Grit by Charles Portis. Thinking of doing something sort of in that style for myself, and love how spare his writing is. And at the same time, the same answer is true. My favorite film currently is the Coen Brothers version of True Grit, which is a absolutely fantastic modern Western. Again, very, very spare, very sharp, has a wonderful sense of melancholy almost in its writing, which I really admire.
Wonderful.
4.
It sounds like you already have a pretty magical career and life, but if a magical being granted you one extra wish, what would you wish for?
Oh, definitely telekinesis. In fact, I don't know why anybody ever says anything other than that. It's the ultimate the ultimate thing. I think that would be most helpful for almost any situation. And gosh, I certainly wish that I could do it when I'm sitting in a giant show space or we're building an attraction and I know the thing I need is three levels down and it's going to take me across a river and underneath an equipment room and up onto the roof to get there.
All right. Here is your provocative question. With today's amazing technology, with 3D screens and projection mapping with great quality at a relatively low price, is it not becoming redundant and perhaps even a bit old-fashioned to have classical animatronics in entertainment when screen contents can be quickly and constantly changed and adapted, hence are quicker, more flexible, and cheaper?
I think that in the attraction sphere, as in almost any kind of theatrical form, there is room for multiple things. Obviously, because I'm an animatronics person, I always want something to be a physical thing that takes up real volume. It's really within your presence. The shadows falling on it are real shadows and not pixelated ones. But that being said, I think there is a space always for mixed media in attractions, and it's all about using it carefully and making sure that the writing in your attraction merits having those things. In my opinion, it is difficult to do a screen-based thing convincingly, even now, where you could do it better with a physical something. It should never be something where you use that technology if there is maybe a more expensive alternative. You use it when there is no alternative to that. So my company, for many years, our official registered trademark slogan in trade magazines was "Say no to screens." Mm. And I still feel that way a lot of times because there is a certain immediacy that animatronics have that no other technology will ever be able to deliver, no matter how good the digital media is, because they're in your space, you know, and there is a certain living quality to them when done well that nothing can ever beat.
That's a great answer, I think. And also, myself coming from the storytelling perspective, I think it gives much more realness to have a real animatronic deliver at least the key lines or at least introduces to the world. And I think it has this emotional aspects as well.
Absolutely. So many years ago, we did a project for the U.S. government and for the Department of Defense. And essentially, it took an immersive training space for the Marines. And it was a very detailed, realistic village in Afghanistan. And they used multiple technologies within that to train Marines who were going to be deployed to combat zones. And one of them was projections on walls. They were pretty convincing. And they were interactive. Some of them were even live mocap with a live performer. And the trick was, though, that the Marines going through and the other trainees from other services going through would realize, oh, that's flat. Mm-hmm. I don't need to interact with this the same way. It's not really a threat. So we were tasked with building animatronics that went into that space that were high fidelity, that you could actually shoot at using your special effects rounds. They could shoot at you and they could react to that. They could fall over dead. They could, you know, pull hidden weapons, things like that. And because of that, the immediacy of the threat completely changed. And so much of what we do, not only in the theme park world, but in other uses for this, is all about suspension of disbelief. And something like that immediately made it to, I'm not staring at a wall full of flickering light. I'm making eye contact with this robotic animatronic character, and I don't know what it's going to do next. And that changes the game completely. I think that's the big difference, is even now, when you look at a screen, you kind of take the whole thing in optically. But when you meet an animatronic character, you look at its face. You expect it to do something that a living thing would do. And there's something kind of romantic in that.
That's beautiful. You've mentioned some of the more unusual uses of animatronics that we don't immediately think of. Of course, we know in theme parks, there's a lot of animatronics. And Disney has recently released some new amazing ones that I think we have to talk about later as well. But what are some of the uses that you supply for that we might not think of, that we might find surprising?
So the military project, I think, is a great one for that. That was such an unusual experiment in that sort of work. And it also dealt with branching storylines. Most of the time, Piraten, other attractions like that, you sit down, you go through, the animatronics don't know you're there. They're going to say the same thing, whether or not the room is empty. If you have something else, though, that is aware of your presence, that changes the game quite a bit. So that's interesting from the military project standpoint, where we wanted to make characters that appeared to be aware of and reacting to what you were doing, to your inputs. We also have animatronics that are in unexpected locations, like grocery stores. We work with a large grocery store company on the East Coast in the United States and have provided dozens of animatronic characters to their stores in a brand building effort. And that's kind of neat because it can take something that is a visual iconic medium with their logos and things like that and turn it into something that is dynamic and moves and wants to engage you. You know, they encourage you to dance with it. And that's sort of fun. That's an unusual type of thing. So really, there is not a one instance of an animatronic that is typical. We get so many different calls for things all over the place, from TV and film to theme parks to people's homes. There's a large collector's market for animatronics. There's never usually one use case where it's normal. They're all unusual and wonderful.
Brilliant. That sounds so intriguing. I've never even thought about the possibility to have an animatronic at my home. That could be interesting.
It's very interesting. And it's been something I should mention. Yarnholt Productions, my company, is 47 years old this year. Our founder was 16 when he founded the company. And one of his first clients was a private collector who wanted all these things for his house, all sorts of crazy fun stuff. And it's sort of interesting when you think about it from a manufacturing standpoint, that what we do is this magical toy factory. It could be anything. And I think collectors kind of dig that because there's things we do that you can't get anywhere else. It's very special.
And I've also had a little snoop around your homepage, and I saw that you built this huge array of different characters, from dinosaurs to people to animals and fantasy figures. What is one of the most unexpected characters or animals that you have created to date?
So we created, I think it's probably safe to say, one of, or maybe the smallest animatronic characters that were some little slugs that we built for a little boy wizard attraction in Japan. And they had multiple movements. They were silicone. They looked just like a real slug. And we've also built giant 45-foot tall fire-breathing dragons. The technology that goes into those things is similar. It's a kite versus A330. You know, it's the same sort of thing that gets a similar effect. But I think that's sort of something that's unexpected, is just the breadth of what goes into those sort of characters.
Do you secretly have a favorite one that you're like, yeah, that I love all of my children to speak, but one of them has a special place in your heart, maybe?
I think there's actually a few of those here and there. And through the history of our company, there's certain times and periods when that has certainly been the case that were important to how we grew and how we changed. Garner would say that, you know, our unicycle riding animatronic character, Wendell, which he created back when he was basically the only employee, but it needed something that would wow the industry. And it really rides a unicycle without any visible means of support. Wow. It's magical. That's an important one. You know, Chuck E. Cheese, we built over 500 of those for restaurants all over the United States. There is hardly a kid in America that doesn't know that brand or had a birthday party or attended one there. That's a big thing. And more recently, some of my favorite things are some things we've done for the Efteling over here in the Netherlands, for Symbolica. Some of the characters we did here for Piraten. I love the dancer in Batavia. That was one of the first characters I animated on this show. And she's just got a really wonderful range of expression without having to be very complex. That's a big part of what we do even is, if you script something carefully, it doesn't need to do much. It just needs to be perfect to match your story that you're trying to present.
Is there something that you'd like to tackle that you haven't so far?
There are some IPs that I would love to tackle, just things that are personally kind of fun. Animatronics are interesting because they're in some ways a unique theatrical genre. Everybody's done a pirate. Everybody's done some sort of an anthropomorphic animal that plays a guitar, you know, something like that. You know, but I'd like to do something really unusual and unexpected in the way that Wendell is sort of a magic trick. So we're just starting now to work with some organizations that will allow us to be doing autonomous animatronics that can actually walk unassisted into a crowd, across a stage, through a scene, something like that. that's really magical. When you can do something where it appears that what you're doing is impossible, that's the most fun type of illusion, I think.
Do you think AI will be a bigger thing in the future, that you build AI that can really respond independently to the interaction?
I hope so, because there are so many neat potential avenues for something like that that can enhance the guest experience, where it becomes truly non-linear, and it doesn't have to feel like it's always A to B to B to C to D. It can be something totally organic. And if it makes sense, if it's truly, you know, properly put together AI, something like that, it could be a really interesting experience for guests. That being said, I would like to say, too, in defense of the old school style of animation and animatronics, there is a certain theatricality in animatronics. In the same way that a person moves in a stage play is different than how they might make that same performance in a gesture standpoint in a film, or if they were just having a basic conversation in real life, the gestures are different. They're more broad. There's a little bit of a different nuance to it. And there's a big movement now in the animation world to capture more of a sense of realism and fluidity in figures, which is admirable, I think, for a lot of ways. But there still is that theatrical aspect to it that doesn't want something to be real. It should not be a convincing human. It should be the princess from that film, you know, that moves differently. And I think that's something that you would celebrate rather than thinking, oh, this is a limit of the technology. So in that same way, even, you know, realism, interactivity, AI in a character, to me, is less interesting than a very well choreographed experience for a guest. Because one of the reasons I think guests want to come to a park is that they have a safeness to it, that there is, a Disney historian called it the architecture of reassurance for what we're doing here. It's that everything's going to be okay. And it looks like maybe we're in danger, but it's that fun kind of Halloween night danger. And I think that there's something for animatronics that wants to stay there rather than jumping off the stage. I have no strings on me, that sort of thing. It wants to have that theatrical aspect.
That's a really interesting thought. So is that something that you also consider when developing the look and the feel of the characters, so that you don't end up making something that ends up being kind of uncanny valley?
Absolutely. And that uncanny valley is a real danger as we move closer and closer to that sort of realism. I'm a big fan of what we call sort of the Norman Rockwell approach to design, where it's 90% real and that last 10% is something that makes it just a little bit caricatured. The important thing is to make it intentional. Don't make it looks silly because the sculpture is not good. It looks silly because in the 5 seconds you're going to spend with this in an attraction, you have to know that that character's motivation is to be silly, to be threatening, to be scared, whatever it is. That's a challenge from a character design standpoint. But yeah, I would always try to aim for something that has that type of immediacy to it from a design standpoint.
We've already kind of talked about this new age of animatronics that gets more real and more smooth in the movements. And looking at Disney's Swinging Spider-Man with those stunt elements, or the walking acts in Droids in Training at the Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, or even the little thing from Disney that we've seen, the adorable Officer Hops that can potentially walk independently in the parks. Is that where we are headed generally in the animatronics world?
I think that's an aspect of it. You know, really, the theme park world back in the old days, when everything was predicated on selling the most individual tickets possible, was all about, we need to move as many people through this ride as we can. The economic dynamic has changed now, where that's usually not as important for a park. So because of that, you don't have to focus on, we need to get the most people through this experience as possible in the shortest amount of time. You can have it broken out where it's okay to have an experience that maybe only 10 people can be in front of comfortably. I think that's interesting because it paces and nuances the guest experience throughout the day in a different way. It's the difference between having a one-on-one conversation versus watching a lecture. And again, I think there's a certain sort of magic for that. So I hope that we'll continue to see those things. That being said, those are costly. You know, animatronics of that type are very expensive. The technology that goes into them is often years in the making and research. And those are just even the latest examples. Disney has been doing those, I'm speaking as a fan here, for many, many years, starting back with Lucky the Dinosaur. Remember that, which was an independent walk-around character, which at the time seemed amazing, and now I think would feel kind of dated. Some of the Muppet Mobile Labs, which was a fantastic untethered experience that went out into the parks. But I think we're going to be seeing more of that. You know, there's mixed-use things where Disney has a Mandalorian walk-around character in the parks with an animatronic Grogu that's part of the experience. And when you have something like that in a packaging like that, where, again, it feels impossible that that could be creative mechanically, it has to be alive. There's something real there, something really wonderful.
How close do you think we are to having a walkable, especially small or inexplicably large character that's a total animatronic?
I don't think we're all that far, honestly. And one of the things is, if you look at robotics development for walking robots and things like that, one of the things that that is the trick, again, back to the theatricality aspect of it, is teaching something to keep itself upright is one part of the equation. Teaching something to keep itself upright while it's walking, and now it looks like it's doing a stylized certain type of walk. It's a specific character's walk cycle, or it is matching something that looks very organic and fluid, and it's not just merely a structural thing. That's going to be the challenge, I think. Animatronics side of it, we've been doing that kind of thing for a long time above the waist. We can make that look real. And so that's going to be the trick, I think, is just making the walking feel like it's organic and natural, and it isn't something that is purely a mechanical effort.
Okay. And of course, speaking about the crazy developments that we see right now in the industry, looking at Tangled and Frozen and those amazing Disney animatronics that everybody seems to be talking right now, most people and most parks seem to be aiming to take the animatronics to a new hyper-realistic level, where you said, in your opinion, the last 10% still need to be not hyper-realistic. How do you think that will play out in the future? Will there be a race for the next best animatronic?
I think there'll always be something like that. And that's something that Walt Disney tasked his early Imagineers to do in the early 1960s, was to keep doing that. And his words, to keep moving forward, opening new doors to new things. And it was always with the attempt that it be something more real. But if you look at it this way, animated films almost never have very realistic looking drawings, and that's intentional. It's the same reason that early animatronics in the Walt Disney period from the 1960s, even 70s, 80s, had a very distinct stylization to the character design, and even to some extent to their movement. And I think that that, again, goes back to that theatrical quality. But even with the beautiful new attractions at Fantasy Springs at Tokyo DisneySea, they move beautifully, they move very smoothly, but they still look like the screen versions of themselves. And that's super important. That's something way back when we started doing a lot of attractions with the big parks like that, it was told to me this way, you know, you're not making a robotic expression of this character, you're making the character. And because of that, you have to fit everything inside. You know, mechanically, it's got to fit within that, no matter how tight the constraints are. It has to move like that. The costume has to look like that. The eyes have to look like that, you know, and that's the special challenge for that. So that's where I think even in, especially in the IP world, we'll be getting more and more realistic, but we're always going to be doing it in the service of whatever that character is.
And that stylized, established comic kind of look or whatever it is that the original has.
Exactly. One of my colleagues, when I first started at my company, said that we don't refer to our animatronics as animatronics, you know, as that as a product. What we make is characters. And that's true. We're not making a skinless robot, you know, or even if we make something like that, it has a story and it has, in a way, a soul.
So is that the biggest constraint that you have, that all the technology that you mentioned, all those wires, all that, I don't know, I'm not a technician, has to fit inside that tiny body, that tiny head?
That's one constraint. I think anybody who deals in almost any industry, but maybe particularly the creative industries, will know that our biggest constraints are always time and money. Mm. You know, rarely is it vision, because luckily we're very blessed to work with lots of different organizations that have excellent imagination and ability to communicate that. But yeah, it's always a function of time and money on that. But when we were working with a company to make a collectible version of Grogu from the Mandalorian series, that was the challenge that we had. Was you have an animated figure that is the size of a, you know, medium piece of fruit, and yet we have to have 25 distinct motions within that very, very tiny area, and you can't violate it. You can't have him wearing a top hat because you couldn't fit everything inside the head. It has to be this character, indistinguishable from its film counterpart, because you're making an emotional story connection with something like that. Again, it's not a robotic representation. It's really Grogu, and you're really inhabiting a space with the character.
That's crazy. Yeah. So is it a lot of fiddling and kind of trying to make it work? Or how do you approach the limitations of such a tight space?
Most of the work that we do now has either an entirely or a primarily digital pipeline. Mm-hmm. Rare is it now where we will sculpt something in clay, and that's the first time we've done it. Most of the time now, we will either create or receive a digital asset we make ourselves or from a client, and we will say, this is the envelope. Mm-hmm. We have this much space. This is the creative intent. It needs to be able to do these movements. It should be able to do them this quick. A lot of times we'll have an animatic that's a little short digital film of the character going through its movements. Mm-hmm. Yeah, previs for that, that shows, here's the show, here's what a guest will see when it's going through an attraction or when they're watching it on a stage or whatever it is. That will help to inform locations of movements, ranges, speeds, things like that. So most of the time, we have already figured out a lot of that on the digital sphere before we ever move into the real world. And we can model things now so in such detail that we can put the real motors and the real axes of rotation into things such that what we're creating digitally is identical to what will eventually be created on the outside. It even can go to the extremes of the shell design or the body envelope design that we create digitally. We 3D print in a material that is then itself the final part used in the attraction. So it's an interesting road to get there. There is still a side of it, though, that, and this is where I kind of love that there is still this, everything we make is a prototype. Even if we're making 30 things in one attraction, we just delivered a huge scope for a client in Asia that had over 30 unique animatronic characters in it, all different costumes, sets, props, special effects, all sorts of cool stuff. And within that, much of it was 3D printed. And still, though, there was an aspect of that that we have this wonderful digital pipeline that uses all sorts of CNC and modern machines and all that sort of stuff. And yet there is still a human aspect to it in machining these parts down in the assembly and all that. And there always will be. It's a very specialty type of manufacturing. Animatronics may be the most niche of all the niche things, because there really isn't a particular reason for it to exist outside of creating joy and telling a story and being an enhancement to something that's already there. So that there's something special, I think, to that. But we do still do a lot of what we call bench building, where we'll say to an animator, we need it to do X, Y, Z things, draw it out in a pencil. And sometimes our clients, that's what they want. Other clients want a detailed design package that has engineering and analysis and all of that. And that makes sense because our equipment is used heavily. Mm-hmm. If you think about it this way, most of the time an attraction is open, or at least is operating scenically, for 12 hours a day, every day of the week, and in many parts of the world, every day of the year. Sometimes they'll have built-in downtimes, but many times not. So they need to be able to operate like a car almost. You know, you need to be able to lubricate them, gas them up, recharge them, do whatever, but they have to have a high level of availability. So there's a lot of engineering in the brains part of things in addition to the beauty.
You're currently working with one of our emotioneers, Lars Hansen, who has also supplied a question that he would like to ask you.
Ooh.
In your eyes, what's the single most valuable characteristic of an animatronic that no animated character or a 3D screen will ever have?
I think, again, harkening back to the immediacy of the experience with an animatronic character, is you can have something on a screen that is fully convincing, but you know it's never going to break that fourth wall and come towards you. And that's something that I think is the most pure, magical form of an animatronic. Even ones that aren't done very well, is they still have a physical presence in the set, and how they're administering the story or how they're administering the emotion that you want to be taking away from that. So it's all about physical presence for that. The way a light falls across a character's face, the way that you can light it from below and create shadows. You know, it's like holding a flashlight under your face and telling a scary story. You can do that too with characters. And in doing that, you can change so much of their dynamism and their power in expressing that kind of story. So it's all about, to me, immediacy, physical presence that a screen can't do.
Yeah. Of course, your main business is in creating that magic and that illusion, but have you ever considered building a walkable or drivable animatronic that can help aid as a real-life avatar for people with physical disabilities or something like that?
I love that idea, and that's something that we have worked on co-developers with. Early on, Garner, our founder, had worked with prostheticists and other schools and colleges or in hospitals to make prosthetic limbs for patients that, frankly, weren't able to get things that looked very realistic. And so they were having sort of self-vision issues with things like that. And so we were able to help them with their confidence in making these beautifully, highly realistic prosthetic limbs. And since then, we have worked with other organizations to talk about things like that. And I think, and I really hope, that that is where the convergence of our technologies is coming together. I love what we do. Animatronics are much more akin to a puppet than they are to a robot. A robot is something that has an important job to do. Not that entertainment and fun and joy aren't important, but they have something that is more important to an industry or to a human. And animatronics are something that has a aesthetic job to be doing. But at some point, I think you're exactly right, there is going to be somewhere where those things have to come together for things like helping robots in the home that maybe don't want to be cold. They want to have a human aspect to them. When that happens, we'll be there for it. We've already started developing things. A few years ago, we came out with an expressive face that had over 42 distinct movements in the face alone that could basically replicate any expression a human is capable of. Something like that is important because you can say and tell a lot without saying a word with something like that. And that's important for all sorts of different patients and different levels for various needs. So we think that something like that, that kind of technology, can be a part of that whole new frontier.
That's great. I think too, of course, your main passion and your main business has to be in entertainment, and that's wonderful. And I think entertaining people and making people laugh and giving them hope and entertaining dreams is so essential to health and making people happy. But also the physical side of helping people in that kind of way is beautiful.
Yeah, totally agree. One of the things we're doing now is it's probably the most important work we've ever done. About a decade ago, Garner and I were talking, and we had this idea for something we then called Project Blackboard. And the idea was that it was a way to introduce animatronics, art, and technology to students. Because I think there's a big interest for the building aspect of that, the creative aspect of that, that is something that most students probably don't think about. It's the weird little kid like me who wanted to watch Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln over and over again at Disneyland instead of riding Space Mountain, who appreciated something like that. But I think that it is kind of rare. So some time went by, and we founded a new company called Garner Holt Education Through Imagination. It's its own separate business entity from our main company, and its entire aim is to offer products and services and experiences for students. And so we work with elementary all the way up through university level. We have tours that involve students of all ages coming to our studio, learning about what we do from an artistic industrial manufacturing standpoint, learning that we have over 50 unique jobs that people can do here, real careers that you can be interested in doing too, which is cool. It ignites a spark, plants a seed in these students that they may otherwise not have. And then we have kits that teach different principles about mechanical movement and animatronics and art and sculpting and figure finishing and paint and things like that. And more advanced versions of that, we make special animatronics called Sparkies. That's a very clever acronym that I can't remember what it stands for, that go into schools. And we have those in schools all over Southern California and other parts of the United States that come with a curriculum about writing and costume design and character design and lighting and programming and voice recording and editing and basically everything that goes into creating an animatronic presentation. We've got first and second graders doing this now. The coolest thing we do is something we call the Anna Makerspace. And it's like a makerspace in a traditional sense where there's machines and materials and things, but it tells a story. And the story is we are creating an animatronic theatrical attraction production. And so with that, it's basically a miniature Garner Holt Productions, and we have those in elementary schools, middle schools, high schools, and colleges. We are now putting them into community-based, open to the public, libraries and other experiences and community centers like that, where the public can come in, use these machines, and create something wonderful that tells a story and has an emotional impact on an audience. So that is kind of the legacy, I think, project that we're focusing on now. We're moving outside of purely entertainment and theme parks, moving into education and doing something that can resonate with a child and potentially change the course of their lives. That, to me, is the coolest magic that we've ever done.
7 years from now.
And as always, our last question on this podcast is, what will the world look like in 7 years regarding your areas of expertise?
Well, there's a lot of really exciting development happening in the theme park sphere, which is great. I think that after the pandemic, owners and operators realized, wow, that appetite didn't go away. It got bigger. And so guests are really hungry for new forms of entertainment, new investments. The Walt Disney Company has announced, $60 billion in spend globally on their attractions. They have my phone number, by the way, so they know where to go. And that's a great thing, I think, globally for all of us as vendors to work with the park owners and operators for that. So I suspect in 7 years, you know, there's a huge, wonderful new theme park opening in Orlando at Universal next year. That's cool. That's going to be another, you know, huge ripple effect type thing, I think, in that sort of industry. But I think that just because the public has proven and guests have shown that they still want this, they want more of it, they're not going away. And as even this certain generation of Disney kids is now getting annual passports and bringing their families and their kids, it's becoming a different kind of tradition where it's not just you go there a couple times in your life. You go there a couple times a year. Mm-hmm. You want to see, how does it look at Halloween? How does it look at Christmas? How does it look in the summer? And that totally changes that dynamic for guests. So I think in 7 years, we're going to be bigger and better where we are. There's so many exciting things opening in that amount of time that I just can't wait to see them.
With amazing new animatronics.
I sure hope so. I think it's neat to me that here is a technology that has its roots back in the ancient Greeks building steam-driven and little mechanical figures that would move in temples up to the fantastic 18th and 19th century automata of the European builders and magicians and things like that. And we have that same tradition that's inspiring us today. How do you make something that doesn't appear to be alive move and behave like it is thinking and breathing and determining its own motion? That's something really special about our technology. And because of that, I don't think it's going away.
brilliant. And just really quickly, regarding trends or regarding the technology, what do you think in terms of technology and that kind of stuff we will be seeing in 7 years?
So interestingly, if you track where animatronics have come from their inception in the modern sense in the early 60s with Walt Disney's Enchanted Tiki Room at Disneyland through World's Fair to Walt Disney World in 1971 and on like that, the biggest change was their industrialization and their kit of parts nature. You know, no longer is this experimental. We're doing something that is, it's not a kit car that we're building in the garage. It's now a Detroit assembly line. And that made a huge difference. But really, up until not very long ago, the changes were not huge. They were very incremental. You know, new skins. The same hydraulic actuators that were being used on Mr. Lincoln at the World's Fair were being used on brand new animatronics up until the early 2000s. They really didn't change.
Wow.
So mechanically speaking, not a huge amount of change until we get to the electric era of today. So several of the animatronics that we built for Piratineer are electric. Many of the ones that we build for other clients around the world are fully electric. That changes not only the motive power, but also the mechanical design and production of those characters in a way that is total night and day. There's very little that's shared between those styles. That's a huge change. The controls was a huge change. In the early days, it was almost the same control system as those old school mechanical automata, where it was a cam that rotated and moved against something that made a motion, you know, going from a shoulder, a cam rotates on a wheel, it moves an arm, moves the shaft, something results in a motion in the figure itself, almost like a watch or something, you know, very highly mechanical like that. It went to larger controllers that were spinning discs that had an optical sensor, moved to tape that had different lengths of mechanical or of electrical impulses that would open and close valves. Now we have things that could fit in your pocket, in your jeans, that could control an entire attraction. The lights, the audio, the video, the animation, all of that. Very, very simple. So that has been one of the biggest changes. And I think the next big change is how we arrive at the performances for those figures in terms of motion capture for people using a fully digital pipeline to realize Maya or other digital software-based animation translating into the physical animation of the character. This is becoming so common that it's almost de rigueur for a lot of the big parks. So I think we're going to be seeing more of that. And again, I think one of the big trends that a lot of the park companies are interested in is how do we make it so that we're not having a predictable experience that's in the can? How do we have an experience that feels organic, feels like it's happening in real time? So I suspect that it's going to be more and more of that. So mechanically speaking, we're where we're going to be. It's all about the brains now.
Brilliant. I'm excited for that. Thank you so much, Bill, for joining me today. It's been an absolute pleasure to learn more about you and the amazing world of animatronics. A big thank you also to everybody listening, and be sure to tune in again next time when we uncover more of what the world beyond has in store for us. Take care, everybody, and thank you, Bill.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for this inspiring exchange. Together as Emotioneers, we have once again gained fascinating insights and expanded the boundaries of the known. To all our listeners out there, remember that the world is full of undiscovered possibilities. Go out and shape our future. Until next time on The World Beyond.
Mac One presents The World Beyond. Brought to you by Michael Mack and his Emotioneers of Tomorrow.